from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, Beat Generation poet Gary Snyder spent 40 years on mountains and rivers without end. His epic poem about Zen Buddhism, Native American mythology, and man's connection with nature. I have found that if you let a poem sit around long enough, you come to see and hear it better, Snyder says. A longtime environmentalist who has worked as a fire lookout and meditated with Japanese monks, Gary Snyder has lived off the grid in the Sierra Nevada for over four decades, and he'll join us to talk about the release of the newest edition of Mountains and Rivers and how nature, politics, and religion have shaped his poetry. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. One of the nation's leading poets, San Francisco-born Gary Snyder, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1975 for Turtle Island, and his magnum opus has been released. It's an epic poem of 39 unified poems spanning four decades entitled Mountains and Rivers Without End, and it blends Asian artistic tradition, Native American storytelling, Zen Buddhist philosophy, and much more. First published in 1996, a new edition was released by Counterpoint Press. And Gary Snyder, I ought to mention, is a recipient of the Bollingen Poetry Prize, as well as Orion's John Henry Award and the Robert Kirsch Lifetime Achievement Award, and has taught for many years at UC Davis, and joins us in studio for this morning's second Forum Hour. And so good to have you back with us.
Nice to be back.
Actually, I did a Commonwealth event last night with Phil Bronstein, who reminded me the last time you were on was with the Will Hurst film. How did that go? Just to kind of for an update. That was a film that was made in conjunction with Will Hurst, I guess.
Yeah, and Jim Harrison and myself wandering around over the big green hills down on the coast and talking about a whole lot of stuff.
And it made it into a lot of theaters, as I recall, didn't it?
For a while it did, yeah. But, you know, it's a very low-key, soft-spoken, and somewhat elegant film. And it's nothing that you would call edgy. So
I don't know that I'd call your magnum opus here edgy either, although it has its edgy moments. It's really a celebration of life, of humanity, of nature. It's an ambitious poem. It's kind of your Cantos or your Patterson or your Leaves of Grass, isn't it?
Whitman, yes. And then Ezra Pound.
Yeah. Two major influences.
Two major influences, and both of those influences genuinely American and extremely different from each other.
And also William Carlos Williams, though. No idea but in things. I've always associated you with kind of Williams ethos.
Yeah, but my poetics are not like Williams.
No, but you're in the American grain, is what I'm saying.
I'm sure, yeah.
There's a lot of American landscapes here, in addition to, I want to talk to you about, but the title actually goes from a Chinese scroll painting, right?
Well, Mountains and Rivers is the Chinese binomial word for landscape. So anytime they talk about landscapes, they use the term mountains, rivers, and that's because China is very mountainous. It's more mountainous than the United States is, actually.
Mountains are kind of the seminal influence on this poetry, really, right?
That's where I started really looking at landscapes, was when I was working as a fire lookout, two seasons in a row, up in the North Cascades, just south of the Canadian border.
And the poems first got underway in 1956, and I was reminded of April 1956, reminded that though many people remember or certainly talk about Allen Ginsberg reading Hall in 1955, the year before that, Gary Snyder was part of that reading, too.
The reading at the Six Gallery.
Yeah, here in San Francisco, right?
Yeah, well, there were five of us reading there that night.
Yeah.
And, of course, Allen swept everybody off their feet with reading Hall, which I had heard an earlier version of over in Berkeley about a month before. And at that time, his working title was Strophes.
this has always been the title for this magnum opus of yours. I mean, right from the beginning, hasn't it?
Yeah, because I knew that there were traditional Chinese landscape paintings, and these are the shoujuan, the horizontal scrolls that unroll on a long flat table, and some of them are as long as 30 or 40 feet long, as opposed to the hanging scrolls that people are more commonly accustomed to. There are a number of shoujuan on horizontal scrolls that are called the Mountains and Rivers Without End class of scrolls.
I think you saw one in Cleveland, in fact, my hometown.
Well, I used that one as the basis for the first poem here. But there are a number of others, and I've looked at a number of others in different Chinese collections, museums of the world. I went all over the world looking at them for a while.
Well, your travels all over the world come through in this poetry. I mean, a lot of American landscapes, but you have been in many places on this planet, and it comes through in ways that are, well, mystical, metaphysical, but also really very elevating of the spirit, I must say, as a reader of yours for many years. It's a remarkable collection of poetry that has a kind of unity and coherence all of its own. It represents 40 years.
40 years I worked on that, but at the same time, I was always writing another category of poems, which made up the 15 or 16 books that I published in the meantime, too.
Fortunate for us, yes.
So I divided my poetry mind into two categories, and it worked.
I was thinking when you were talking about working on the mountain and you've been living up in the Sierra off the grid for years, but you also worked as a fire watcher and you worked as a trail maker and as a lumberjack and logger. I mean, all of these labor positions that you've held have really shaped you to a great extent, haven't they?
I'm a West Coast guy. I grew up in the Though I was born in San Francisco, my parents moved up to the Pacific Northwest, and my father had four brothers who worked at either in the woods or in sea, and then it was the middle of the Depression, and I learned how to do all those things and had the skills and the tools to do it by the time I was a teenager, and so I was as much working out in the woods then as any time later. I started young.
It's also given you a great sensitivity for ecological and environmental matters. When did you begin to absorb and become involved in Buddhism? And the East, really, in general. And I don't mean Bronx, obviously.
Well, actually, it was Buddhism. You know, it was Buddhism that got my attention first. And that's because, when I was about 9 or 10 years old, I ran onto something that said, that the Buddhists believe that we should have a moral regard for all living beings, not just a moral regard for human beings. And that really snapped my mind when I thought back to a few times I'd gone to Sunday school. My parents were not enthusiastic about anything like church, but they let me go to Sunday school for a while just for cultural reasons, you know, like cultural Jews. A cultural Christian. I didn't last very long because they told me that one of our milk cows that died would not go to heaven. And I said, well, I can't go there then. And so when I learned that the Buddhists had, and also some of other religious traditions in the world, have an ethic, a morality that includes all living beings, I said, that's how I feel. And sort of in
precocious lad that you were, yeah.
Well, I was in the forest. You know, we had a dairy farm located in the middle of an ex-forest, in the middle of one of those big clear cuts where they took down the virgin forest of the Pacific Northwest and made Los Angeles and San Francisco with the lumber. And so it was full of big stumps. I mean, big stumps, 10 feet high and 8 or 9 feet in diameter, each stump. And so I meditated on that a lot.
Talking with Gary Snyder, his book Mountains and Rivers Without End has been re-released with audio and, in fact, said that poems kind of marinate after a fashion. You read them differently after, say, 40 years or 25 years or whatever the case may be.
Oh, well, you learn more about what the poem's about
as
you go.
Which implies that, you know, you don't necessarily know what they're about when you first write them, or you have the perspective of time.
Both.
Yeah. And this particular epic poem, which is really one of my poet friends said, writing an epic poem is almost comparable to building a house, maybe more likely a fortress or a castle. But this poem, you said, I think, and I just want to make sure that I have this right, that it goes back to Buddhism. It goes back to a sutra of a female Buddha named Tara.
Tara, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us how that ties into this whole vision of yours.
Well, the Buddhist tradition has a strong feminist, I won't say feminist, but women's world underpinning to it. It is it's a non-dualistic tradition in which the wisdom of the male and the wisdom of the female, if we can use those terms temporarily, are both given full credit. And that creative and the woman side of it is evident from early on with certain sutras and certain pieces of literature that are in which there are women speakers, women, enlightened women are lecturing us instead of enlightened men. You get both in Buddhism. And the Tara figure, she's the most popular figure in all of Mongolia, Nepal, Tibet, and is the ancestress of the Chinese, what we think of as Chinese bodhisattva of compassion, Guanyin, who is a female, but she's never represented looking very female. Mm. Whereas Tara is notable for, in the Tibetan scrolls, in the Mongolian scrolls, for her bare breasts. No doubt about her gender. You know? So there's a whole body of meditations and a body of lore and also dances that go with Tara that they're not really part of Zen on any known surface, but they're there too.
It's your own Buddhist pedigree. You write about this. It goes back to Jodo Shin or Pure Land Buddhism in Berkeley.
Well, that's not my pedigree, but it was the first place that I met ethnic and cultural Japanese people who were living it from day to day. And they were Japanese Americans in the Jodo Shin, the Pure Land School. The Pure Land School is a wonderful practice, a wonderful school of Buddhism, which says, don't practice. Don't do anything. All you'll do is get in your own way.
Well, you know, you said before you're a guy of the West, and the West in both senses, the West Coast, the Northwest, Western world. And you have spent most of your adult life absorbing, studying, meditating on Eastern philosophies and Eastern ways of thinking and so forth. They used to say East is East and West is West and never the twain, but they can meet and they can be absorbed. I remember an interview I had years ago, maybe even spoken to you about this with Ken Kesey, when he said, we're too Westernized. We can't really become the Eastern thinkers that we might want to be or aspire to be. But in many ways, you have become that. I mean, you're a guru for many people.
I wouldn't want to say that was exactly what I've done. I'm really trying to think in planetary terms. And what shaped me first, although, I mean, I picked up on the, as I was saying, the Buddhist ethic, I found that same ethic in Native American spiritual practice. I didn't really meet Buddhists, but I met Native Americans when I was a kid on the farm. In fact, we bought smoked salmon from them. And so that's the other side of it. And it's in it's very much woven into Mountains and Rivers Without End. It's not just Native American. Actually, it's the other world, the greater part of the world that has lived over the last, the Homo sapiens world of the last 50,000 years.
You see it as really human heritage in the broader sense.
It remains the major human heritage, mm-hmm. even on Earth. Even on the planet right now.
And no drama figures in Mountains and Rivers Without End, too. I mean, you're kind of an aficionado of no drama.
Yeah, yeah, no drama doesn't mean no drama. That
no,
means and, no drama.
Yeah. It's a Japanese form of drama. Yeah.
It's a Japanese form of drama that I admire as one of the world's major art forms. And so I drew some insights, or I think they were insights from that, in constructing the way this poem was put together.
And calligraphy plays a very prominent role here, too.
Well, we're talking about a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of stuff in this poem. I'm trying to, you know, as we used to say in radio, cover the waterfront, at least to some degree. We can't cover it all. People are going to have to read it. In fact, people probably should hear it. Can I ask you to read something from Mountains
sure.
and Rivers Without End?
Sure.
And we should mention that the new publication includes Gary Snyder reading from, what do you get? Like, in fact, there are three discs that go
three CDs, yeah. Right. And done by a an extraordinarily skillful guy with his all the right equipment and his studio, Jack Loeffler, based in Santa Fe, who has spent the last 40 years taping, doing musicology with Pueblo, Hispanic, old ranchers all over the Southwest. He's a really well-known guy in the
Southwest.
How'd
you find him, or where did he find you? Or
oh, you know.
The dots connect.
We connected in the Bay Area around peyote or something way back about 60 years ago.
Memories of peyote. So what do you want to read for us?
I want to read, thinking about these various things, something called We Wash Our Bowls in This Water. It's page 124 there.
Yeah, we've each got our text here. Go ahead, Gary.
Not just mountains, but rivers, you know. There's both. There's both waters and mountains. And as the Tao Te Ching says, the waters fall, the waters flow downhill and will make their way regardless through everything to where they're going to go. And the mountains rising bring down the clouds and bring down the snow. And so the mountains and the rivers are working together at opposite ends, doing opposite things together all the time. And so I realized at a certain point in going through all of these things through the years, I needed to spend more time on rivers. And I started doing river running with really crazy, riotous, nutty friends. Somehow river runners are
They're a different breed.
They're a different breed from mountaineers.
Yeah, oh yeah, a different breed, period.
Yeah, so here we go. With a little quote at the beginning. The 1.3 billion cubic kilometers of water on Earth are split by photosynthesis and reconstituted by respiration once every 2 million years or so. All the water is out of the ocean and back again in a cycle of about 2 million years. So it's a day on the ragged North Pacific coast. I'm getting soaked by whipping mist, rain squalls tumbling, mountain mirror ponds, snowfield slush, rockwash creeks, earfuls of falls, swirls of ridge-edge snowflakes, gravelly rivers, tidewater crumbly glaciers, high-hanging glaciers, shoreside mud pools, icebergs, streams looping through the tide flats, spume of brine, distant soft rain drooping from a cloud, and sea lions lazing under the surface of the sea. We wash our bowls in this water. It has the flavor of ambrosial dew. Ga shi simpatswe nyo ten kandro meat. Beaching the raft. Stagger out and shake off waters like a bear. Stand on the sandbar. Rest from the river being. Upwellings, side swirls, back swirls, curlovers, out ripples, eddies, chops and swells, wash over shallows, confluence, turbulence, wash seam wavelets, riffles, saying, a hydraulic is a cross between a wave and a hole. You get a weir effect. A pillow rock's a total fold back over a hole. It shows spit on the top of the wave. A haystack's a series of waves at the bottom of a tight channel. There's a tongue of the rapids, the slick tongue, the V. Some holes are keepers, they won't let you through. Eddies, backflows, we say eddies are your friends. Current differential, it can suck you down. Vertical boils are straight up eddies spinning. Herringbone waves curl under and come back. Well, let's get going. Get back to the rafts. Swing the long oars. Head into a storm. We offer it to all demons and spirits. May all be filled and satisfied. Om Makula Sai Swaha. Seyo Kijin Shu Shichuryo Toku Homan. Om Makara Sai Sowaka. Sudung Po. got sat out one whole night by a creek on the slopes of Mount Lu. Next morning he showed his poem to his teacher. The poem was, "The stream with its sounds is a long broad tongue. The looming mountain is a wide awake Buddha. Throughout the night, song after song, how can I speak at dawn?" That was in the 9th century.
I noticed, by the way, excuse me, but there, and this is lovely to hear, and the way you're reading it, changing words too as you read it. I mean, it becomes a different poem in certain word selections. Body became Buddha, and because I was following the text, it's as if, you know, you're still experiencing it and absorbing it in an entirely different way. And
I learned that from Robert Duncan, who said a poem is never finished.
Well, I like that line, and I believe in it. But ere you finish this poem, we're running short on time here, I just wondered about, I can't help responding, how you feel as a lifetime environmentalist. When you read lines like this about acidification and about mountains being blasted and about glaciers melting and pollution, I mean, does it occur to you as you render this natural beauty to us?
Well, nature can handle all that.
You think so?
Oh, yeah.
From your lips to whomever or whatever ears are up there in the divine. So finish it for us. We've got just...
It's just a few more lines. The old Roshi, the old Zen master, Chang Tsung, who was Sudongpo's teacher. Sudongpo was one of the most famous poets who ever lived in China, and he was the governor of all of South China for years while doing his own Zen practice and writing, you know, probably the top poems in the whole country, 9th century A.D. So in the poem, "Sounds of streams and shapes of mountains, the sounds never stop and the shapes never cease." Was it Su, the poet, who woke up, or was it the mountains and the rivers? Dogen says, giving his lecture on this poem, "Billions of beings see the morning star, and they all become Buddhas. If you," speaking to his monks, "if you who are valley streams and looming mountains yourselves can't throw some light on the nature of ridges and rivers, who the hell can?"
Even threw in the hell there. As I said, the text changes, the poem never stays the same. Gary Steiner with us for this hour, an opportunity for you to talk to one of our greatest poets. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your involvement in the program and join our conversation. His new book, again, Mountains and Rivers Without End. And I'd like to hear from you if you have questions or comments for Gary Steiner, who is reflecting on a poem that has been 40 years in the making. We welcome your involvement. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and you can go to our Facebook page. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Professor Emeritus, University of California, Davis, the newest edition of his book, Mountains and Rivers Without End, has just been released, and we'll continue with Gary Steiner after a brief break. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Gary Steiner, often characterized as beat poet Gary Steiner, because he was part of the Beat Generation. He spent 40 years, though, on the poem that we're talking about and focusing our attention on. It's been republished. It's called Mountains and Rivers Without End. It's an epic poem about Zen Buddhism and Native American mythology and man's connection with nature. I always think about Woody Allen, who said, "I am too with nature." But there is that transcendent sense that one gets from your work. And one of the things that you've taught me as a reader of your work for many years is how you can combine the feeling of what borders on the eternal, I guess, and that's in your title here, or the transcendent, with the flux that we're in, with the evanescence that we're in. And I experience them simultaneously in your work. You might want to hear from other listeners who have been readers and appreciators of Gary Snyder's poetry to weigh in here on your response to his work. And again, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And I should mention that Gary Snyder is also a longtime environmentalist who has worked as a fire lookout, meditated with Japanese monks, lived off the grid in the Sierra Nevadas for over four decades in a house that he built. And here's a listener talk about the Beat Generation, another pedigree. Mr. Snyder, just after you first published Mountains and Rivers, I picked up an old battered copy of Kerouac's Dharma Bums, where he records that you, as Jaffe, had started work on your life's work, Mountains and Rivers Without End. I was amazed that 40 years ago he chronicled you so accurately. Could you talk about your relationship with him, and could you talk about your relationship with your Zen mentor, to whom I believe you dedicated your book? He was the grandfather of a friend of mine.
I've had several Zen teachers, so I'm wondering which one of those this man is speaking of, but my main Roshi in Japan was Oda Sesso Roshi, the abbot of the Daitokuji Temple Complex and the teacher of the monastic training center of that whole temple, that whole complex. So I can't quite answer that.
Well, you can talk about Dharma Bums, though, right? I mean, you were the prototype for that.
The Dharma Bums is a novel.
Yeah.
Let's not call Kerouac a journalist. It's a novel, and some of it is reflects things that happened with me as a person there. Some of it is totally fictional. And so give Jack credit for his creativity, and that's about all I can say about that.
How do you remember Kerouac? I mean, you remember him fondly or mixed or what?
Well, you know, I knew him during a rather benign period of his life in which he was funny. And very sharp and very much right on a lot of the time, and genuinely bashful, and had an excellent memory. And so I enjoyed his company enormously.
He went from right on to being right, basically.
But later on, yeah. You know, we had some falling out, and I wasn't in touch with him for the last 15 years of his life, where he sunk into more and more alcoholism.
And I think what can best be characterized as right-wing politics.
That too, yes.
A listener named Faye writes, a better schooled friend than I, a Buddhist historian, said the Dalai Lama delivers a hodgepodge of advice not purely Buddhist. Can Gary Snyder take on the big guy, the 14th Dalai Lama, and speak truth to power? The unquestioning acceptance of the Dalai Lama reminds me of Sheldon Copp's 1970s book, If You Meet a Buddha on the Road, Kill Him.
Actually, Sheldon Copp didn't say that. That's a traditional Zen saying. And it's presented as a koan. If you meet the Buddha on the street, kill him. Now, how do you deal with that? You have to go before your Zen teacher and show the teacher how you respond to that, how you manage that one.
How do you manage it? How do you respond to it?
I'm not going to tell you.
I mean, secret of like so many of the mystical Buddhists.
They're only useful, you know, as insofar as you find it yourself.
What are your responses to the Dalai Lama? I mean, the listener says there's a hodgepodge of advice from the Dalai Lama.
Well, good. Not all advice is Buddhist advice. I mean, there's a lot of good advice that you can get from other places. So the Dalai Lama is quite expert at picking up all the best advice from everywhere. And he is genuinely a sweet man. And I think his best, you know, for him, way of dealing with who the Chinese are. He said, you know, we're just going to have to wait until the Chinese all become Buddhists. He says, that'll take a while.
Yeah, like, many millennia, I would guess. Frises writes, I recently saw a mini documentary of Mr. Snyder by Richard Moore at the Writing from California Conference at the San Francisco Public Library. And I want to know if Mr. Snyder thinks the influence of poetry has changed in California since the 60s, and who is his favorite contemporary poet? I'm going to put you on the spot there.
Poetry and culture and art are always changing. And in particular, right now, in the world that we're in now, I feel like Rip Van Winkle half the time. I went into the REI store over in Berkeley yesterday, and I didn't recognize anything. You know, the skis are all painted with colors, and many strange things taking place. So I'm not going to worry that the poets change, too. My favorite poet in the world right now at the moment, I have two. One is dead, died recently. That was the Polish woman Wisława Szymborska, a marvelous poet who died in her 70s or 80s.
Are there good translations?
there's five or six translations of her books out.
I don't know her at all. Who's the living poet you were going to mention?
And Les Murray.
Ah, yes.
The Australian poet, right, who does things with the English language that I really admire. And he's a very funny, tough, cranky guy. So there you go.
There you go. Let's go to some more of our listeners. Callers, bring you on. Bob, you're a first caller. Good morning.
Good morning. Gary, 40-some-odd years ago, you and I stood at Hanshan Temple in Suzhou, and you gave a copy of your translation of Cold Mountain Poems to the old priest there, and you said, as you bowed to him, "This book has finally come home." I don't know if you remember that day, but you wrote a poem about it. Allen Ginsberg was sitting on Maple Bridge and wrote a poem. And all of us who were there felt that this was a rather magical day when your translation of Zhang Ji's 7th century poem about the temple and all of that just brought East and West and old and new and everything together in a very beautifully coherent way.
Nice memory there, Bob. I remember most of that myself. And here's one funny little thing that I've discovered since. Zhang Ji, of course, is extraordinarily famous, and everybody knows him. Like when we talked about, when I was in Hong Kong last, and talking with a bunch of younger journalists about Zhang Ji, they all recited his Maple Bridge poem from memory right there in front of me. About a dozen of them, and he said, they said, "Oh, we all learned to memorize that in grade school." But Hanshan is not, or Cold Mountain is not in the Chinese canon. And so, what I've been having fun with lately is the bafflement of the Chinese literati as to how somebody that they don't know very much about has become perhaps the most internationally famous Chinese poet, all because of these dumb little translations.
Being modest for a change. Let me thank you for the call, Bob. Good memory indeed. You start off with this Dogen painting of a rice cake here. Why?
Because that's Dogen's thinking at his very best, mm-hmm. And his most complex. And it leads to an interesting place where he says, the paints used to paint these rice cakes, which are real things that you eat with tea, are the same paints as with which you paint mountains and rivers. If you say that those paintings are not real, you're saying the whole phenomenal universe is not real. How do you deal with that?
And green tea plays a role here too?
Well, it would for them, but it could be black tea.
let me go to more of our callers. This is John who's joining us next. John, you're on the air with us. Hi.
Oh, thank you, Michael. First, thank you for taking my call. Second, there is a Gary Snyder poem that has always spoken very much to me. I'm from San Francisco now, but I born and raised in a town called Farmington, New Mexico. And Gary, you may remember from Turtle Island, I believe, the poem, "I Walked into a Maverick Bar in Farmington, New Mexico."
I remember that poem.
it's a beautiful poem. There's a great line about the tough old stars. Which I think about often. And there's the poem ends with you walking out, or a line about the work that is to be done, the real work that is to be done. And I wanted to ask Gary what that work is, what he's referring to about the real work that is to be done.
Yeah, I end that poem saying, well, got to go up, get back outside, think about the real work, the work that is yet to be done. I don't think I have to explain what that is. I think we all know what the work to be done more or less is, and it's not always the same for everybody. To confuse the issue a little more, the latest news about the Navajo Nation that I've heard in this regard is, back in those days, they were really very much against the coal mining on the Navajo Res. Now they're thinking of selling coal to China.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a complicated
world. You left me wordless on that one. Thank you for the call, John. Good to hear from you. And we'll hear from some other listeners in a moment. In fact, if you'd like to join us, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can join us by email, forum@kqed.org. Your work began really with Rip Rap, didn't it?
First published book, yeah.
And, I mean, in terms of really establishing yourself as a poet and really getting the kind of recognition that's been steady.
Well, that little book had,
had a lot of life to it.
Had a whole lot of impact and life to it, more than I imagined. I wrapped that up while I was living in Kyoto, and we first printed it up in an edition in Kyoto with bound Japanese style, sewn binding. And Lawrence Ferlinghetti paid for it and sold it out of his bookstore, and it was gone in just a few weeks, all 500 copies.
Wish I had purchased one. Here's Jim in East Palo Alto who writes, I attended a celebration of Gary Snyder's epic poem at Stanford, perhaps, 10 years ago. I think the event coincided with the publishing of the poem in an earlier form, or as it stood, circa 2000. Does he intend to add to it for the duration?
No, it's a finished poem. I'm not adding many more to it.
And Dave writes, it would be interesting to hear about Gary Snyder's relationship with Suzuki Roshi and other Zen teachers. Suzuki Roshi was the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, and their impact on his development as a Buddhist and as a poet.
When I came back from my long residence in Japan, almost 12 years, for a while I was over on near Pine Street, and that was the first time I met Suzuki Roshi, Suzuki Shunryu Roshi, the teacher and leader of the San Francisco Zen Center. We had a very lovely meeting. I sat Zazen over there a few times, and he came to lunch at my place, and he complained Americans don't have enough sense of humor. But they were Soto Shu, and the Soto branch of Zen doesn't use koans. I put my time in with the Rinzai people working on koans, and so those two schools of Zen run parallel, but not exactly the same.
You also got to know Alan Watts back in the day, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. We got to know each other because we were both doing italic cursive calligraphy. Yeah. I wrote him a letter about, my youthful interest in Zen. He wrote me right back saying, where did you get that pen, and how did you learn to write that way? And he was a remarkably good calligrapher.
Kelly tweets, hi, Gary. What role, if any, does language, specifically Asian and Native American languages, play in this poem? Pretty significant role.
Which poem?
Mountains and Rivers.
Oh, it's all in there.
Yeah. Yeah. What about, I remember students saying The Wasteland is difficult because it uses all these different languages. I mean, these are Eastern languages. These are not familiar to many of your readers. And so there are those who might say, why does the poet use languages that we don't know? And you would say what to that?
I'd say learn them.
That's the best response. That's like a Zen koan response. Yeah. And they would say in response, well, I don't have time to learn these languages. Who are you kidding?
Hey, Americans think that being monolingual is normal.
Yes,
it's not. Bilingualism is, over the last 30,000 years, what's normal. Trilingualism. California used to have 35 different Native American languages. Did that mean they couldn't talk to each other? No. Everybody spoke two or three languages.
I used to love the old line about, people who speak three languages are trilingual, two languages are bilingual, one language are Americans. And it seems to follow suit.
Americans and Australians.
Aussies don't...
No,
they're down under too much.
Yeah, well, they're too far away.
Yeah. There's another caller. And Eric, join us. You're on forum. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you.
I'm a graduate student instructor at UC Berkeley right now, working in an interdisciplinary class, Intro to Environmental Studies, with poet Bob Haas and a soil geochemist Gary Sposito. And right now I'm sitting at my desk evaluating some papers from young students, and they were asked to interpret a couple of your poems, specifically Night Song of the Los Angeles Basin, or Walking the New York Bedrock Alive in a Sea of Information, and interpret some of your thinking and your imagery about the city as an ecosystem. And some of the things they've come up with are just amazing. And I asked them to kind of go out on a limb, and this is their final writing assignment, and it just really tickled me to be reading these young students' papers and hearing you on the radio at the same time.
That's great. I love hearing about it. I hope some of those students will send me some of their, the versions of what that might mean that they come up with.
You learned a lot from your students, didn't you?
I mean, yeah.
I've learned an immense amount from my students.
Yeah, I learned a lot from what they didn't learn, too.
Yeah, that too. We're talking again with Gary Snyder and Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Davis, and the newest edition of his book, Mountains and Rivers Without End, has just been released. This book is a sutra, is it not?
Well, it's not really a sutra, no. A sutra has some specific qualities. So I use that term kind of loosely there.
Well, it's didactic, and you're not afraid of that word, are you? I mean, because you're a teacher.
Yeah, but the word sutra means a discourse delivered by a Buddha at a certain place at a certain time, and the sutra opens with saying which Buddha gave the talk, where, and who was in attendance at it. They all do that. You know, so I didn't go through that. But my Smokey the Bear Sutra is a sutra, although it's not very long, about a mysterious Buddha called Smokey the Bear.
Dan, did you know that Smokey the Bear was a Buddha? No, neither did I. Let me bring another caller on here, and that's Bill from Berkeley. Hi, Bill.
Hi, this is Bill from Gary from the Berkeley Zendo of about 35 or 40 years ago. The Zendo moved to where it is now on Russell Street, and we went to your place and cut several trees down and used them in building our Zendo. And the four pillars of the Zendo that really hold the building up and together are from your place, as you may remember. You came visiting to the Berkeley Zendo after we got the Zendo finished, and nobody recognized you except me. And I came down here and opened the Zendo and showed you inside, and you were very happy to see your four trees in their new role as supporters of our temple. And you taught me the word. I was concerned because one of the pillars had these round, perfectly round holes in them. And I asked you about it, and you said, yeah, they're okay. There's some kind of, you told me what beetle it was. The dust that came out was called phless. So you taught me that word and increased my knowledge of the world by one, knowledge of the world of words by one at that time. So I always treasured that one meeting with you, and I hope you remember it. But if you don't, it's still an important time for me as well, for me. So
thank you for the call. I'm glad you added a word, Gary, to his vocabulary.
Yeah, the word is frass, F-R-A-S-S. It's a German word, and it's mostly used by loggers and forestry people. It's a great word.
We thank the caller. Listener writes on Facebook, my father introduced me to the beat poets, and you were always his favorite. Can you talk about the similarities and differences in beat personalities and characters that helped in your creativity and collaboration? I have a broad question, but what comes to mind?
Oh, you know, I'm not that influenced by beat poetry, really. That's not the kind of poetry I write. My teachers were in the Bay Area, however, even before Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac turned up on the scene, were Kenneth Rex Roth and Robert Duncan. The memory of these two great men has lapsed a little bit in the American literary world, but it'll come back. I think that Ginsberg learned a lot from Rex Roth, actually.
And you mentioned Ferlinghetti before.
I mean, and Lawrence, yeah. Of course, yeah.
And Rob writes, when I visited Japan a decade ago, I was interested to find that Kuan Yin was portrayed in the early days as a male figure. Later, and since, Kuan Yin has been portrayed as a female. And when I asked people there about how and why the transformation, all I got were shrugs. Do you have any insight to offer about how and why Kuan Yin started out as a male and has ended up as female?
I'm not sure that Kuan Yin started out as a male to begin with. I think it's just Chinese Puritanism. That they and the idea of feminizing, of letting the Guanyin or Avalokiteshvara figure look female is just bothers them a little bit. But on the other hand, in Tibet, Avalokiteshvara is a male, and the Dalai Lama is the reincarnation of Avalokiteshvara in this time and place. There's some confusion there. The confusion is good.
Especially for poets. Do you have any confusion about the Chinese government and its relationship to Tibet, or are you pretty much on board in terms of wanting them to essentially abandon their control over Tibet?
You know, I have turned down all my invitations to China for the last 25 years. And I go to Hong Kong because in Hong Kong I can speak to newspapers and say what I think about Tibet. But if I went on to the mainland, I would get whoever had sponsored me in big trouble for talking about Tibet. But that's not the only thing. The Chinese have not yet come to terms with how to handle their environment. And they're driving themselves and everybody else crazy, hoping to become number one in the world and a major industrial power by burning cheap coal. What a mistake.
I agree with you on that, although I must say I did an event recently for the Public Policy Institute with George Shultz and Stephen Chu, former Secretary of State, former Secretary of Energy, and Mary Horton, who's in charge of the Air Resources Board in California. And they were, I think I'm speaking for all of them, pretty optimistic that work could be done with the Chinese, that the Chinese were trying to do something about their reliance on coal and actually felt somewhat optimistic.
Well, you know, our government is trying to be optimistic about it, you know, but that's, what else can they do?
Well, here's Alan who writes, I was recently doing research in Kenneth Rexroth's archive at USC and found a poem in TypeScript called Two Poems by Han Shan at Old Age. Do you know if Rexroth had been interested in Han Shan or was this something he developed later learning about Han Shan from you? I don't know if Rexroth ever published this poem, which is in TypeScript and seems very rough draft.
I've never seen that poem either, but I do know this, that I was the person who introduced Kenneth to Han Shan. Because I was doing work in the East Asian Library as a graduate student in East Asian languages. I supplied him, you know, with the original texts for several things out of that library.
And here's Gail who writes, I'm listening to you now in southern Costa Rica. About 44 years ago, you spoke, radio wonderful, about 44 years ago, you spoke to the internet, I don't know how she's listening, spoke to the student body at the University of Massachusetts. I was about to move to California. In addition to enjoying your readings from Turtle Island, I remembered forever the poem you said was the shortest you had ever written. Sourdough, French bread, and Pinot Chardonnay. Do you have any more beautiful short poems like that?
I do, but I can't read them on the radio.
Speaking of Turtle Island, let me bring another caller in here. And Josh, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I love your work, Gary. My question is this. I'm a PhD candidate in history, Aboriginal history, and recently I was discussing the Turtle Island that term, Turtle Island, with a professor, and I was saying that this was a common Native American theme, and he said, well, some people would argue against you that really that's Gary Snyder's invention, and I was just wondering what you felt about that.
Well, it's not my invention. I learned it from Native Americans, first at a big powwow in a riverbed down in Southern California in the middle of the night once. And then, you know, check the mythology out. Check it out, buddy. East Coast and West Coast both have origin myths that involve the turtle. But not only that, you'll find origin myths that involve amphibious serpents or turtles from other parts of the world as well.
You find this, that you get credit sometimes for myths that come from Native people or Chinese culture and so forth because you've kind of branded them with your poetry?
So I borrowed that from the Native Americans.
Yes.
But, you know, what I urge everybody on the continent of North America right now to do is be born again as a native of Turtle Island. Okay.
And thank you, Josh, for your call. Why don't I get another caller on here? Well, Drew, that's you. Good morning.
Good morning. I went to Reed College a long time ago, not too long after you did, and I wondered if it had any influence on you, particularly other than Lloyd Reynolds' calligraphy classes.
Oh, yeah. You know, Reed is over-intense. It's very fierce. It drives you to your limits. I had many excellent mentors, professors, and teachers there that drove me to different limits, and I appreciated it.
They've produced, I think this is still the case, more Rhodes Scholars than any university in the country, and they still don't have grades, letter grades, I believe.
I don't know if they don't have the grades, but they used to tell us that, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, for those of you who are interested, Steve Jobs went to Reed for a couple of years, and he got his sense of typography and of calligraphy from Lloyd Reynolds. He said, actually, I put it into Apple, and then Windows stole it from us.
Well, are you poets still the unacknowledged legislators?
Yeah, and we try to remain that way, unacknowledged.
Well, let's acknowledge the fact that Mountains and Rivers Without End has been re-released by Counterpoint Press, the newest edition of the book, which has, as we said, readings included. Three CDs of Gary Snyder reading the work. You might find what I found this morning. You might find some of the language changing from what's in the text as you read.
Only when I read.
Only when you read, right. What's next for you?
I'm working on a new book of poems that will be ready probably in 7 or 8 months. And then after that, I'm going to have the great fun of doing a kind of a trans-Pacific Buddhist memoir and criticize American Buddhism and tell stories that haven't been told yet.
Ooh, we'll await that with bated breath. This is, your career has been an extraordinary one. Congratulations on the re-release of Mountain and Rivers Without End, and always a delight to have you here. Thank you so much.
It's nice to be with you, Michael.
Gary Snyder, again, his new edition, Mountains and Rivers Without End, has just been released. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you can always continue discussions and let us know what you think by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer today is Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our interns are Keelan Cronin, Nick Zabrowski, Victor Valle, Angela Johnston, and Aaron Newport. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.